So last week, I was trying to reach a fellow veteran sports writer for something I was putting together, and he didn't respond. I know I had his correct phone number because we texted before, and a few days later, a mutual friend told me that he'd received my contact. And to be honest, it really pissed me off. Not because of anything special, I'm certainly not, but because professional courtesy. We all do this for a living. Therefore, we all know the pain in the ass process of tracking people down, of getting folks to talk. And because of that, I try really hard to respond to everyone who works in the business, because oftentimes I'm the one asking, and I know how compromising that can be. Moral of the story, don't be a douchebag. Respond to other journalists. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Bill Rabinowitz, the Ohio State beat writer for the Columbus Dispatch. This is episode number 334. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you're culturally irrelevant.
All right, Bill, you've covered Ohio State for a long time. You've been at the Columbus Dispatch since 1999. That's a shitload of Ohio State football. I know that's not the only thing you've covered through the years, but it's your main beat. A couple weeks ago, on Twitter, the coach of the team, Ryan Day, was trending. It was this video of him, and it was after they beat Notre Dame. And I mean, I know you've seen it, but him like kind of bellowing and
like, I'd like to know where Lou Holtz is right now. What he said about our team, I cannot believe. This is a tough team right here. We're proud to be from Ohio, and it's always been Ohio against the world. And it'll continue to be Ohio against the world. But I'll tell you what, I love those kids. We got a tough team.
And I am not a fan of college football, and I'm really not a fan of Division I coaches. There's a lot of stuff with that I do not enjoy. And that video actually, for me, merged it all together into one little snippet. And I wonder for you, as an adult who's been covering this stuff for a long time, how do you view all of that? Is it performative? Is it real? Do you take it seriously? Do you take it with a wink? What is that we're seeing from these guys?
I think for Ryan Day in the moment, it was very real. I mean, you have to think about it from their perspective. They put in ungodly amounts of time and effort. And being the coach at Ohio State is a very high-pressure job. Yeah, he's rewarded handsomely. Nobody's feeling sorry for Ryan Day. But he had heard ever since Michigan beat them 2 years ago that the team is soft. They lost to Michigan again last year. They came very close to beating Georgia in the playoff. This is their first marquee game since then. They win with a play at the – they score 1 second to go on a 1 yard run. And so he was all excited. And he'd heard all week that Notre Dame was tougher than Ohio State. So that was all that bubbling out and boiling over. Do I take it seriously? I mean, I think it's him in the moment. He's normally not like that. You know, he's not a bluster guy. So it was a little bit out of character for Ryan Day to do that, certainly publicly, because he's usually pretty close to the vest and things and not so emotional. I think it was just the emotion coming out in the moment.
When you got to Ohio State, the head football coach was John Cooper. Since then, we've gotten Jim Tressel, Luke Fickell, Urban Meyer, Ryan Day. And I have a friend who just started covering USC football, and he was actually in the news last week because program took away his credentials for 2 weeks, then backpedaled the whole thing. And it does seem like covering a college program is limited access, is certain restrictions. It's this, it's that. And I wonder, like, from the first time you stepped foot into a college football locker room till now, how has the coverage and maybe the restrictions, access, et cetera, changed?
Well, I'll correct you with one thing. We actually don't get into the locker room. So that's
there you go.
Now I came to Columbus in 99 to cover the expansion of Cleveland Browns. I did that for 6 years, then the Bengals for 3 years, took over the Ohio State beat. I was asked to do that in 2011. So Luke Fickell and Urban Meyer and Ryan Day have been the coaches that I've covered. The thing that has been something you just have to adjust to is that they make the rules. They decide the access. Ohio State's access is actually pretty good compared to a lot of other elite programs. I mean, I've been able to do some stories that they could have said no to. They could have just not given me the access, and nobody could have said no. You know, there's no commissioner of college sports. There's no, nobody's going to say you must do this. So Ohio State's doing this because, well, obviously they think it's in their interest to do it, but there are no requirements in terms of media access. And so you just have to deal with it. It's frustrating. I mean, I don't like the fact that a lot of the stuff we get comes out of press conferences, but that's, I think that we have somebody on the beat had kind of looked this up. We think that the Ohio State football beat is the largest, has the largest media contingent of any team in any sport in the country. They're all newspapers, websites, TV stations. You know, I know UConn women's basketball used to be that. I'm not sure that's the case anymore. I don't know the answer to that, but it's huge. And so you can't just grant unfettered access to everybody. It'd be a zoo. And so they do limit it, but they do make it so that you can do your job. And that's all I ask. And there have been certain stories that I've wanted to pursue with them, and they've been accommodating. I followed Marvin Harrison Jr. around for a day this summer just to see, okay, what's his workouts apparently are like above everyone else's. What does he do? And so I shadowed him for the whole day. And the irony of it is I watch him do all this stuff. I've been standing there all day, watch him do all this stuff. The next day, who gets injured? Me, my back goes out just standing for 5 hours.
Oh my God. So
I told him that he got a good laugh out of that. So
let's say just hypothetically, you want to do a story next week about, I'm going through the Ohio State roster, Lorenzo Styles Jr., cornerback from Pickerington, Ohio.
Yeah, suburb of Columbus.
Do you go to the SID? Do you say, I want to do the story? And they say, oh, you can just talk with him in the blank. Like, how does that process actually work?
Pretty much. In fact, we would have liked to have talked to him last week because he transferred from Notre Dame. And so that would have been a natural story. We got his brother, who's a starter. Lorenzo Styles is just kind of working his way into the mix Ohio State, so he's not really playing much. But his brother is a star safety. So we did get his brother. But yeah, you would go to the SID, Jerry Emick, who does a really good job, and you say, hey, can I do this? And he'll either say, I mean, he'll probably talk to Ryan Day, or maybe the position coach, and come back with an answer, yes or no. You know, I don't know if we requested Lorenzo Styles Jr., and Jerry will ask, you know, who would you like to talk to? And sometimes you get him and sometimes you don't. I mean, that's the thing. You have to be able to go to plan B, C, or D all the time. And that's frustrating. In an NFL locker room, now they don't have to show up in the locker room, but if I wanted to talk to X player, odds are X player was going to be at his locker, and mm-hmm. you could have a fighting chance to do it. At Ohio State, it's just, you know, you don't go into a locker room, period. And they're college students, so you may or may not get them.
Is it basically like you say, I want to interview so-and-so athlete this week? And then do they say, well, what is the story you're working on? And then they go to Ryan Day and say, well, he's doing the story about how he transferred here from Notre Dame, blah, blah, blah. And Ryan Day could say, I don't feel comfortable with that actual story.
I'm not sure it's that detailed. I mean, I think it's probably obvious when I would request a player why I'm requesting that player, but not always. I recently did a story on Josh Fryer, who is a right tackle, starting right tackle at Ohio State. I did that for the Notre Dame game because he's from Indiana. I mean, I had no idea about this until I talked to Josh, but his father apparently suffers the effects of CTE. And there's no way to diagnose that definitively until, you know, you're dead. But he has the symptoms of it. I had no idea about this until I talked to Josh, and Josh basically told me. And then I talked to the parents. I talked to Jeff Fryer and his wife, and I thought it was a pretty good story. Now, I didn't tell Jerry that because I didn't know, you know. Right. And I don't. So a lot of times it's obvious why I would request a certain player, and other times he might ask that. They might ask, you know, why are you doing that player? And I would tell them, I mean, I wouldn't deceive them. And then they'll either say yes or no.
Now, let's say you're interviewing an athlete and these are kids, right? These are, you know, 18, 19, 20, 21 year old kids. I mean, the young men. You're interviewing whoever, Bob Smith, offensive lineman. And you're having this great interview with Bob Smith. And then Bob Smith says, yeah, so that's why I started shoplifting when I was a freshman, because I just thought it'd be a great way to get free clothes. Do you have to keep in mind these are kids at all? Or you just run with the story?
Yeah, I keep in mind that they're young adults. I mean, they're not kids. They're young adults. And part of it is I have kids now. They're actually older than college, but I know kids that age. My kids were that age. And I always think, how would I want a reporter to handle them? You know, if they said something stupid or something they shouldn't have said, I would certainly circle back and say, okay, let's talk about this. And are you sure that you would want to talk about this on the record? If it's an adult, that's different. But I always kind of say that I will criticize players, but I will never twist the knife with college players. You know, and the NFL, like, you don't hold back. You know, if they're getting paid a lot of money, and if they screw up, you just write it. In college, you know, I'm sensitive to the fact that, yeah, you say so-and-so did not play well, so-and-so missed this block, missed this tackle, fine. But you don't say the guy sucks. You know, you just kind of don't make it personal. And I think that's served me pretty well over the years. I think I get more from that approach than being like a real, you know, jerk about things and taking every advantage I can to criticize. I don't think I pull punches in terms of the team's performance. Certainly, if the team performed badly, I don't pull any punches that way. But with individual players, you know, I do take into account that they are 20 years old, roughly.
How does it change your approach, or how do you feel it's changed your approach as a writer to literally be covering people? As you said, your kids are older than these people. Like, you are, they see you as sir and mister. They don't see you as, hey, Bill, that generally. Does it change the dynamic, and does it at all change the way you actually view the sport one way or another?
Well, it's funny, when I was talking with Josh Fryer's parents, his dad said, you know, sir and mister. And I was like, oh my God, I'm your age. You know, please don't do that. Please don't do that. Yeah. And so, you know, and occasionally a player will say that, although Rabinowitz can be a tough name for them to say or no. Yeah. And so I always say, Mr. Rabinowitz is my dad, right? You know, that's kind of the thing. Yeah. And, you know, I always do try to remember that they are roughly my kid's age. And even younger now. And I try to be sensitive to that. And that, yes, they're in this kind of exalted position being an Ohio State football player in Columbus, Ohio, but that comes with a lot of pressure. And they're not fully formed adults the way that somebody our age is. And to make, you know, some kind of allowances for that, I guess. But honestly, it doesn't happen much at all. I mean, I've not had many cases where a player has said something that I thought, ooh, he shouldn't have said that. And if I were a different kind of reporter, I would have run with that and maybe gotten the guy in trouble. It just doesn't happen very much.
A question I think about a lot as a guy who's written books about football, and you've covered football for many years. In many ways, and I'm not saying always, this is a very ruinous sport. I mean, CTE, the physical injuries, a lot of football players wind up not graduating. I don't know what the rate is at Ohio State, but there is definitely in college football across the spectrum, far too many guys you wind up seeing, not that anything's wrong with this job, but working at a Home Depot, 17 credits short of their degree. They had the glory in football, blah, 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 blah. When you're covering it and when you see a really bad collision involving some 18-year-old wide receiver going across the middle or some quarterback's head being slammed into the turf, do you ever second guess the sport or second guess covering the sport?
The honest answer is yes. When I started doing this, when I started covering the Ravens, the Baltimore Ravens, 1996, and there would be, you know, Ray Lewis was on that team as a rookie then. That's how old I am. You know, he'd plaster somebody, you'd think, oh, what a great hit. You wouldn't really think anything of it. I mean, I think with the knowledge and what we know about CTE now, that has certainly changed. That's the first thing I think about. When Marvin Harrison got just decked in the Peach Bowl last year, I thought, oh, man, I hope he's okay. I mean, that was my first thought. It wasn't, what a great hit. It was, oh, man, I hope he's okay. I think anyone who covers football that doesn't have a certain level of ambivalence about it is probably not a really good reporter, because you have to understand what the sport takes as well as gives. And that was actually the lead almost to what the Josh Fryer story was. I think it's a great sport in a lot of ways. It teaches teamwork and sacrifice, and 11 players have to work as one. I think there are a lot of great things about it. I also am not blind to the physical toll it takes on you and the mental toll. And it's a brutal sport. And I have admiration for the players who have the courage to play it. It's incredibly hard. And even just to go through what an Ohio State player, and I think most Division I athletes go through just to prepare themselves to play, the conditioning and the strength training, it is grueling, grueling, grueling work. So when I see fans, you know, rip players, I think, you know, you couldn't go through a half hour of what these guys go through in the weight room. I couldn't, and I couldn't when I was much younger. There have been plenty of times I've questioned, am I contributing to this? But I also think that it's a great sport. So there is that balance you try to strike, and that ambivalence, because you know what the long-term effects could be. Now, I hope that with equipment changes and knowledge and concussion awareness, that is being minimized. So I think it is safer. Does that mean it's safe? I, you know, I'm not a doctor. I don't have any idea. So there is ambivalence.
You had the joy of covering Urban Meyer. And I've spoken to people who covered him at Florida, and some people were okay with him, and some people just hated covering him and thought it was just not a fun experience to cover Urban Meyer. But I want to put words in your mouth. What was it like to cover Urban Meyer?
We got along fine for the most part. There were a couple of times when I would ask something and he didn't like it, and he would snap at me, and okay, fine. But it's also hard to really be to get the harsh coverage when you're 83-7 or whatever his record was at Ohio State, right? He never lost more than two games in a year. Won a national championship his third year. You know, it's a professional relationship, and he's been helpful to me. I mean, I'll with the two books I wrote on Ohio State, he gave me plenty of time, which I'm eternally grateful for. I just finished this Cardale book, Cordell Jones' autobiography. He helped me with that in terms of, you know, I'd ask him about certain things, you know, related to Cardale, and he was great. And Cardale was at times critical of Urban Meyer. And so, that way he's fine. You know, I don't need to be personal friends with Urban Meyer. I just, you know, need a good professional relationship. And we have a good relationship. So I understand all the stuff. And I think he did change somewhat from his Florida time. I think he learned from that. I think it was a different dynamic in a lot of ways. I think he recruited a different type of kid at Ohio State than he did at Florida. You know, I was not Florida, so I don't know for sure, but that's kind of what he told me. Obviously, everyone knows about all the police issues, the issues at Florida. There really were not those issues at Ohio State. And the minor ones that cropped up could not really be attributed to him. They were just kids being kids.
Does it matter if the coach knows who you are? Would it actually have changed your coverage if Urban Meyer had no idea who you were and you were just Bill, reporter?
I don't know, because it wasn't like I got tons. I mean, it wasn't like I got tons of exclusive access. I mean, other than the books, it wasn't like, you know, he had his press conference and then he called me into his office and said, okay, here's what I really think. certainly wasn't like that. I think it's always good to have a good relationship with the coaches that you cover and as many people as you can. You never know where you're going to get the information. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to write it, but it informs what you know of the team. And so you don't go down the wrong paths. Sometimes it's not what you write, it's what you don't write that's wrong. And so if you can have people that you have a good enough relationship with to say, no, that's not true, then you don't go down that road. And we as a newspaper, you know, we can't be wrong. I mean, obviously we make mistakes and nobody's perfect. But we can't throw stuff against the wall and hope it sticks just because it'll get clicks like a lot of outlets can. We just can't do that. So there have been plenty of times when I've known something or was pretty sure that I knew something, or my beat partner, Joey Kaufman, same way. And we just have to wait till we know and we have it pinned down. And that can be really frustrating because you know it, but you can't report it. Now, hopefully there are some people out there that are savvy enough to realize, okay, if the Dispatch is not reporting it, it's because they haven't pinned it down. It's not because they're oblivious. It's kind of a tough question, but generally speaking, I think it's good to have a good relationship. But I remember telling Urban Meyer when I started the books that I may discover things in the course of reporting this book that you're not going to like. And that's just the way it is. You know, right. He was fine with that.
Do readers in Columbus expect you to love Ohio State?
I think fans everywhere expect the writers that cover the team to be fans of their team. It's fun. You know, I'll be honest. I grew up an Ohio State fan. I'm from Dayton, which is about an hour away. My parents met at Ohio State. I wouldn't be here if not for Ohio State. I think I was offered the job, offered to be June 15th, 2011. And that's the day my fandom ended. And even now my dad will say to me, you know, don't you really want to do it? And I'm like, I don't think that way. I think, you know, when you're at a game, you're rooting for you, you know, whatever's easier for you to get through the day, you're rooting for you. So the fan part of it just is not, I just don't think of it that way. And I know that's hard for non-journalists to understand, but you just have to have that. You just have to have that mindset.
I hate the line like, well, I just show them I'm a fan. Like, it's not that hard to not be a fan. Like, you have a job. Don't be a fan. Not that difficult. It's the most overrated thing in journalism. Like, it is not hard to grow up rooting for the Giants, start covering the Giants and say, all right, I'm done rooting for them. I have a job now.
It was the same thing with the Bengals. I was a Bengal fan growing up. I started covering the Bengals. I covered them like I covered the Browns, who I hated growing up. You know, I don't think somebody could read my Bengals coverage and Browns coverage and say, oh, Bill grew up hating the Browns and loving the Bengals. You just become a professional and you just cover the team the way it needs to be covered. And being a fan, I don't even know how it helps you. I think it can only hurt you. You don't think of critical questions to ask. You know, you could be a fan. Great. Just don't cover the team.
Yeah. Not complicated. Last year, you wrote a very lengthy and very good piece about C.J. Stroud, who was the Ohio State quarterback last year. You wrote it last September. And there was this real deep dive into CJ and his life. And you wrote, CJ's father had overcome imprisonment for a drug conviction and armed robbery about 20 years earlier to become a pastor and successful executive for a communications company. He delighted in helping coach CJ, traveling as far as Florida for AAU basketball tournaments. Sierra said her father was the first person who tabbed CJ to be a quarterback. And it's this really deep dive into CJ Stroud when you just don't see that many deep dives anymore into college athletes the way we used to, when you could open up a Sports Illustrated and it'd be six pages about like Rex Kern, Ohio State quarterback. I did that for you, by the way. Like,
very, very good.
Yeah, thank you. You don't see those that often. When you're like, I'm going into this to figure out CJ Stroud and I'm going to write this long, whatever, 3,000 word deep dive. Is Ohio State cool with that? Is CJ Stroud cool with that? And do they have to be for you to even do that story?
Well, it's funny. That happened very organically and unexpectedly. It was just going to be a feature on CJ Stroud. And I knew about his father's background, what had happened to his father. So we start the interview. It's supposed to be like a 15-minute interview. And CJ mentions it. And I say to CJ at one point, you know, look, I don't want you to do anything you're uncomfortable doing. This is a private matter. If you want to share it, obviously I'm all ears. But I don't want you to feel compelled to do it. And he was like, no, I want to basically, I don't know if he said this, but I think his thinking was, okay, I'm going to do this once, do it right, be done with it. And he started telling me about it. And I just listened. And Jerry Amigby, I said, he was nearby. And he was like, okay, CJ, I think time's almost up. And he said, nope, I'm good. And he kept talking. I think the approach I took in that case was the right one. I mean, I think if I said, tell me about your father, you know, that would have never worked.
Right.
And again, I didn't want him to do something he would have been uncomfortable doing. I mean, this is a private matter, but the fact that he felt comfortable enough or whatever, you know, rationale he had to do it. I'm grateful for, I mean, I was happy with the story. And then obviously I talked to other people. I talked to his mom for a long time and she fleshed things out. I talked to his sister and then, you know, lots of people, obviously. So a lot of times these stories just happen, hopefully, because you're a good listener during an interview. You know how to, I don't say prod, because I don't think that's the right word, but encourage somebody, if they're willing to share things that make the story much better.
Is the SID always in there when you're interviewing athletes?
No. He happened to be that day. You know, it was the quarterback, and I don't think CJ had done a big interview before or a lengthy interview before. I don't know, but no, he's not. It's not like they're looking over our shoulders and doing that.
Well, I was going to ask, does it change at all a dynamic if you have someone from the athletic department in the room while you're interviewing someone? Do you feel like you need to almost like stand between the person you're interviewing and the rep? You know, does it change it?
I mean, I guess it would depend on who the SID was and then the school's kind of attitude toward that stuff. I mean, Jerry Emig, fortunately, he understands our jobs and lets us do our jobs. I think if he thought there was an inappropriate question, that he might step in. But as long as it's just a natural conversation, no, he wouldn't. But yeah, it's a little, you know, weird to not have it just be you and the source, you and the person. But it's not a big deal to me.
Well, you wrote in the story something that stood out to me. The season opener on the road against an experienced Minnesota team provided a stiff test. Stroud threw for only 58 yards in the first half and threw a costly interception as the Golden Gophers took a 14-10 lead into intermission. In the locker room, Stroud glanced at his phone. "People are killing me," Stroud said. "At the time, I didn't know how to react." Day did, he reassured him. Are these guys allowed to check their phones at halftime? Is that a common thing?
Maybe of all the things he said in that story, that might have surprised me the most, that he did check his phone. I just thought, what? Now, college halftimes are longer than NFL halftimes. NFL halftimes are like that.
Yeah.
So you have a little more time, 20 minutes, I think. But yes, he did. I'm like, you know, I always think of that as they get there and they're game planning and doing all this stuff, which I'm not sure is really true. But you know, I'm sure the coaches are doing that. But I guess he had a couple idle minutes and thought, yeah, I wonder what's going on. He was also a freshman at the time. So yeah. I don't know. That was funny.
Wait, I have a weird question for you. You write in the piece about Stroud's faith. And Hall told Stroud they need to be thankful to God. I didn't understand, Stroud said. I'm like, thank him for what? For getting me hurt? Don't get me wrong. I wasn't being defiant to what God was trying to do. I was just confused. This is the biggest game of my life. Luckily, I listened. The whole night I'm praying, thanking God for supernatural healing. The next morning, I felt movement in my shoulder and I threw the next day. I swear that if I didn't pray or he didn't explain that to me, I would have never played in that game. That's why I believe in Christ so much, because things like that happen. Okay, I say this as an agnostic Jewish guy, okay? Are we ever allowed to say, ask, so how do you explain 9/11? Like, whenever I hear Deion Sanders talking about how God led him to Colorado, I'm always like, yeah, but have you seen the flooding? And, you know, tens of thousands of people have died. Are we ever allowed to say anything like that?
You're trying to get me fired?
No, I'm not. I'm actually really interested. I'm genuinely interested.
Well, you know, I guess the obvious counter to that is, well, did God want the other team to lose, right? I mean, there's always that thing. It always pops in your head, right? In sports, it's a zero-sum game. One team wins, one team loses. And so you think, you know, God's not really on anybody's side. You know, look, what's my last name? Rabinowitz, right? So my thing with that is, that's their private thing. And if they believe it and if that helps them, then who am I to say, you know, that's for them to say. It's not for me to kind of weigh in. Yeah, that may be the simplest way to answer that, if that makes sense.
I'm just waiting for the day that someone's like, so God wanted you to go to Colorado, but he also wanted 10,000 people to die. Deion, what do you think about that? I know no one's going to. I would have to be in the room and be maybe drunk to actually do it, but you know. You covered the 1999 expansion Cleveland Browns.
Oh, man. Craziness.
Okay. I love expansion teams. I had Sean Powell on, who's now at NBA Network, but he covered the expansion Miami Heat. And really, all I wanted to ask him about was the expansion Miami Heat. All right. Chris Palmer's a head coach. Dwight Clark is a general manager. Tim Couch is the first pick in the draft. After some debate, whether it be Tim Couch, Achilles Smith, or I think Donovan McNabb, they went with Couch. Right.
Yep.
What is it like, and I'm giving you the floor, to cover an expansion NFL team?
Well, it was even crazier for me because I wasn't hired till like the first week of training camp. So I covered the first day of the Ravens training camp, leave York, Pennsylvania. I was at the York Daily Record, drive to Columbus, really drive to Cleveland. I wasn't even in Columbus at all. And my wife and two very young kids were in Pennsylvania, New York. It was horrible. I mean, personally, it was horrible. And I don't know the team. They don't even have a media guide. They have nothing. And the other people covering the team had been Cleveland Browns writers forever. So whatever knowledge there was of Cleveland and the Browns they had, I knew nothing. And I get there, and it was all these players. I was just swimming. I was lost, just lost. Now, I was 35 then, so it wasn't like I was a rookie reporter, and hopefully I, you know, faked it pretty well, or at least, you know, wrote some decent stories to while I kind of got up to speed. But players were constantly coming and going, and Chris Palmer was a nice guy, really, but, you know, frankly, in over his head, and they were terrible. I mean, I remember going to the opener. They play the Steelers, they're arch rival, and there's all kinds of optimism that they might actually be a decent team. And they lose 43-0. I think they got two first downs. It was just like, oh my God. Oh my God. They're terrible. You know, you can't really tell in the preseason or training camp. You can't really tell until, and Pittsburgh just said, you're nothing. You're nothing. And you're not going to be anything for a long time. And there's a miracle they won two games that year. It was crazy. And the way they lost games, even when they got to the point where they were respectable enough to win, the Dwayne Rudd helmet toss game. I don't know if people remember that, but I forget which team it was even. They sacked the team's quarterback, and Dan Rather, linebacker, takes his helmet off and throws it. The play wasn't actually dead because I think the quarterback had fumbled, and a lineman picks it up and runs it 40 yards. Dwayne Rudd gets a penalty for taking off his helmet and gets 15 more yards to kick a game-winning field goal. They lose. It's the craziest ending I think I've ever seen, and there were lots of them like that. It was just insanity.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my daughter, Casey, and what is that on your ankle?
It's a tattoo of a boot.
You got a tattoo of a boot on your ankle? Young lady, you're only 19 years old.
Dad, calm down. It's not just any boot.
I am so angry.
Dad, it's the kicking shoe worn by Garrett Lindholm, kicker for the 2011 Milwaukee Mustangs of the Arena Football League. I wanted to let people know they can go to royalretros.com and buy a hand-stitched, made-with-love Mustangs jersey.
Ugh, did you really have to get a tattoo to do this?
The butt-piercing pavilion was closed.
You're covering the Browns, and Tim Couch is their quarterback. And he's a rookie quarterback, but he's a first pick in the draft. It's actually weird. Tim Couch has gone relatively unscathed in history because of the Ryan Leafs and the Jamarcus right. Russells, et cetera. Right. Could you tell fairly early on that Tim Couch wasn't all that?
Well, I don't think anyone thought he was going to be Peyton Manning, who had been drafted the year before. Mm-hmm. And I still think that if Tim Couch had been on a decent team and not gotten injured, he would have been a more than serviceable NFL quarterback. Would he have been an elite quarterback? Probably not. But he would have been good enough. Worthy of the number one pick? Probably not. But I don't think anyone was that year. Maybe Donovan McNabb, but, you know, he had some good years. But, you know, true number one quarterback? No. I felt mainly sorry for Tim Couch because they put him in a very difficult position. And then when Butch Davis took over, he was not a fan of Tim Couch, and it just kind of went south. And he handled it pretty well. I mean, Tim Couch is from like this tiny, tiny town in Kentucky, not exactly worldly. And he has to get up and be the number one pick for the Cleveland Browns. And I thought he handled it with grace. He was just put in a very, very difficult position. Not much talent around him, obviously, as an expansion team. And mainly, I just felt bad for him.
Does losing beat up a writer the way it beats up a player?
Well, they went through a 10-game losing streak, which in football is 2.5 months.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm driving 2 hours up and back to Cleveland twice a week to cover this team. It was miserable. Because there's nothing that anyone wants to talk about, nothing anyone wants to read. I can't imagine that I wrote anything that anyone cared about. They were 10-game losing streak. That's like in baseball, a 60-game losing streak.
But you know what? No matter what, you can always tell people you covered Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and not be lying about it.
That's true. The running back, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Correct.
31 pick from UCLA.
Correct. I believe. Trivia question. Who was your leading rusher that year?
Terry Kirby. Am I right?
It was Terry Kirby. Very nice.
Yes. I haven't thought about Terry Kirby forever.
Right now, Terry Kirby is thinking about you, hurt that you have not thought of him forever. In 1996, you covered the inaugural Baltimore Ravens season. Ted Martebrodde, the head coach. You had Vinny Testaverde. As you mentioned, you had a rookie Ray Lewis, Bam Morris, and Ernest Biner in the backfield. Was it a drastically different experience in that they were not an expansion team? They were just a relocated team.
Yeah, somewhat, because they were established. On the other hand, you know, the circumstances of that move, the Cleveland, you know, Mark Modell moving the Browns to Baltimore was incredibly controversial. I mean, I'm not sure it was controversial. It was like despised, right? Yeah. I mean, this is one of the great stories. My wife's family is all from Northeast Ohio, from North Canton, and they're all Browns fans. And when my daughter Katie was 3, Art Modell, whatever you think of it, he was the most accessible owner of all time. I had his number. You could call him. One time he called me, and my daughter, I thought, was sleeping. She wasn't. She picked up the phone, didn't recognize the voice, and hung up. And I saw the caller ID. It was Art Modell. I'm like, Katie, you hung up on Art Modell. My daughter became like the hero of the family, hanging up on Art Modell. It was different because, you know, and they weren't very good the first couple of years. The years I covered them, they weren't very good. And I was a rookie NFL reporter. That was the other difference. You know, I didn't really know what I was doing. And I did the best I could. And I was competing against the Baltimore Sun with all their resources and the Washington Post. And they had Ken Denlinger, who was a great reporter and great guy. I mean, he took me under his wing when he didn't have to and couldn't have treated me nicer. I mean, I'm working for the York Daily Record, which was a great paper, but it was a small paper. And you know, I could have gotten buried on that beat. And the Ravens, truthfully, treated me quite well, too, because they wanted to expand into Pennsylvania. New York is only an hour from Baltimore. So they, and again, because it was such a controversial move, they needed all the fans that they could get. So they did treat me pretty well. But yeah, I was just trying to feel my way. And fortunately, being writing for the New York Daily Record, if the Baltimore Sun beat me on a story, nobody was going to say, how could you get beat on a story? I mean, it was the Baltimore Sun or the Washington Post. So I was able to kind of learn and hopefully get better. But it was a fun experience because it was the first major pro team I'd ever covered.
October 19th, 1996. Denver-bound Ravens have steep hill to climb. Dayline, Owings Mills, Maryland. There may be no good time to play the Denver Broncos at Mile High Stadium, where opponents have won only 26.5% of the time since 1974. This Sunday afternoon is definitely not the time the Baltimore Ravens would pick. The Ravens are 2-4. And another loss could put them in danger of slipping out of the playoff picture. Worse, they're hobbling. So nothing wrong with that at all. That's actually good. Like, did you know what you were doing? Did you have any clue what you were doing? You're in this market. You're at a smaller paper, but you're going against the big boys. Did you have a clue?
I like to think I did. I mean, I think that I was a decent writer and decent reporter and could navigate a locker room and all that. So I don't think I was like overwhelmed by it. I just knew that I didn't have the experience or you know, certainly the clout of the paper. And again, the York Daily Record back then, especially, was a great, great paper. We had people that went everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
And so my first job was at a horrible newspaper in upstate New York. And to go to the York Daily Record was like going to the New York Times for me. I mean, it really it felt so great.
Wait, what was the first paper?
Jamestown Post Journal, New York.
What was it like making the jump from Jamestown to York?
I just remember interviewing in York and the vibrancy of the room. You can just feel the vibe of a place, and it just felt so alive. And New York's always going to be special to me because I met my wife there. Mm-hmm. And so it's always a fond spot in my heart for York, Pennsylvania. But it just felt like these were young people who were going somewhere, and I wanted to be a part of it. I was assigned for my tryout story to go cover a high school baseball game. Of course, I know nothing. I come from New York. I'm from Ohio. I know nothing about York, Pennsylvania. So I'm covering these two teams. So I don't even know their nicknames. I get the lineup card, and I'm writing, okay, York Suburban Trojans, and write down So this kid, Matt Eckenroth, throws a two-hit shutout. I think, thank God, I got an easy story, right? The kid throws a two-hit shutout. So I interview him, and he talks about the game. And at the very end, I say, I just want to verify the spelling of your name. Eckenroth. He said, yeah. I said, Matt, M-A-T-T, which is what it was on the lineup card. He goes, no, M-A-T. And I've often thought, what would have happened if I had gone back to the Daily Record offices and written the story about this two-hit shutout and gotten the kid's name wrong? Because it was written that way on this lineup card. And the editor would have said, you got the kid's name wrong, regardless of whose fault it was. 99% of Matts are M-A-T-T. This kid was an M-A-T. And I've often thought, what would have happened? What would have happened if I hadn't asked that question?
That is actually a great lesson. Along those lines, let me ask you, what's your biggest mistake you've made in print?
It's funny. It's not funny because it was my first story with the Dispatch, and it's the Browns again. And again, it's the Hall of Fame game. I get there like 2 days earlier. It's really my first story for the Dispatch. There's no media guide. We only have one seat in the press box, and that's for our columnists. So I'm inside the Hall of Fame in Canton, writing my game story. And if anyone's ever watched the Hall of Fame game, the second half of the game, they're not even showing the game. And they're like just talking. There are no stats. There's no nothing. They finally bring in a stat sheet. There's no roster. There's no like media guide roster. And the Browns had a running back named Malcolm Thomas and a defensive back named Marlon Forbes. I don't know any of these guys. Mm-hmm. Well, in my haste on deadline, I type in, it's like the last sentence of the story, the Browns' leading rusher was, and just, you know, in the heat of the moment, Malcolm Forbes. Oh. Well, Malcolm Forbes is the financier guy, right? A 70-year-old guy. And so the next day, my editor was very kind. He said, hey, I know the circumstance. You did a pretty good job under the circumstances, but I need to point out to you, you said Malcolm Forbes. And I just kind of buried my head by, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. And he's like, no, it's okay, you know, blah, blah. But I felt just horrible. I'm just horrible because, first of all, you don't want to get a name wrong anyway. And then to say Malcolm Forbes, you know, it's like, So that's the one that always I remember. The other, this is a funny one too. In York, you have to work desk shifts and take high school scores and all this stuff. This is one weekday and I take in all kinds of track meets. And then I took a youth gymnastics meet. And so, you know, I was so used to, you know, abbreviate stuff. So like, you know, vault exercise, you know, pole vault and track all. I got it mixed up. So in the paper, I screwed up. And next day we get a call and I see my friend Dave, who gets taking the call, and I can see his face kind of turning white and like something bad happened. And he's like, who took the Bree Berkowitz gymnastics thing? And I'm like, sheepishly, I raised my hand. He goes, do you realize that you didn't call it the vault? You said the pole vault. This little 9-year-old gymnast doing the pole vault.
You know? I gotta say though, these are your worst mistakes. You've had a pretty charmed career in journalism.
Well, I haven't done anything, hopefully, you know, that anyone would think of as libelous or slanderous. I don't think I've done anything like that. But right. No, those are the ones that stand out to me. Just the silly, funny in hindsight, but certainly not in the moment.
Yeah. I just want to say April 21st, 1989, York Daily Record.
Oh, wow.
Matt Eckenroth had inherited the same situation. His only other relief appearance this season. Two runners on base, no outs, behind in the count against his first batter. This time, he ended up giving up a grand slam. Eckenroth did much better Thursday against visiting Susquehannock.
That's amazing. boy, I hand it to you. I have no memory of that, obviously.
Did you win the Pulitzer for that story?
I did.
You did? I did.
I did. Thank you. Thanks for remembering.
You have a new book out with Cardell Jones. Cardell Jones, former Ohio State quarterback. I have never wanted to sort of quote unquote ghostwrite a book because I feel like capturing someone's voice. And also like maybe I don't love being second banana. You write this book with Cardell Jones, leading the Buckeyes, finding my purpose and never giving up. And also like, and I'm not being critical. I wouldn't say Cardell Jones is a household name. It's not like people out here in California are going to be like, oh, Cardell Jones. I remember him with the Chargers briefly. Like,
right.
What was the inspiration for doing a book with Cardell, a guy you covered with the Buckeyes during their heyday?
He asked me and the publisher asked me. So I didn't pursue that them. They pursued me, or at least asked me. And I had done my books with Triumph. And so I just get a call and say, would you be interested in this project? And in my second book on Ohio State, The Chase, which is about the 2014 national championship season, Cardell's story was so incredible that I devoted an entire chapter to it. The only player in either book that I had done a chapter on, just his upbringing, and just it was a miracle that he ever got to Ohio State, let alone did what he did at Ohio State. And so I was not looking to ghostwrite a book. I'd never done it before. I had no idea how to do it. But I just thought, you know, I think it's a great story. And obviously, Cardell's not a writer. If they're going to trust me to do it, then okay, you know, I'll do it. And so we collaborated on it. And I think it's a good book. You know, I think that he is a household name in Ohio. And so, you know, I don't think Triumph is thinking this is going to be a national bestseller. Look, I hope it is. I hope it right. does great. But for in Ohio, I mean, Cardell Jones is a big name. And he's, you know, he's got a great personality. My wife loves him. My dog loves him. There's a picture of my dog with Cardell in the book that I'm just so over the moon about. and I think it's a great story. It's an inspirational story because he came from just, I mean, I'm sure there were people that came off. It had worse factors. He did have a support system around him. The book is not about the three games that everyone remembers, the Wisconsin, Alabama, and Oregon games that made him an overnight star. The story, the heart of the story is what he overcame to get there. Yeah, I mean, most people were early in his career, the only reason they knew about him was the silly tweet that he had about, I'm not here to play school.
Oh, yeah, right.
That was all people knew about him until JT Barrett got hurt and Braxton Miller had gotten hurt before him. And he's suddenly thrust into the starting job right before the Wisconsin game. And they need a blowout to have any chance to get in the first playoff. And they beat him 59-0 because Cardell's had lights him up. And so I understand when people buy the book, they're probably going to jump to those three chapters. That's fine.
Yeah.
But I certainly hope that they read the whole thing because of the story itself, how we ever got to Ohio State and survived the first couple of years at Ohio State. It's just amazing.
I feel like there is a potential with a book like this to sell an absolute shitload of copies in Ohio. Like you set up a table before the Ohio State home game against so-and-so, right. And you guys sit there and he signs and he poses for photos. Is that sort of the plan? Is that how you approach this?
Well, he's going to do it much more than me. I mean, I'm not, people are going to buy it because of him, not me. I mean, My name's on the cover, but it's his story.
Right.
And I've told him, this is your book. This is your, you know, I'll do what I can to promote it because obviously I want it to be successful. Nobody's going to buy the book because of me. They're going to buy it because of Cardell.
Let me ask you a final question, an important and, as you know, required question on this podcast.
Yes.
What's the best confrontation from your career?
You know, it's so funny because I was talking with Joey Kaufman before, my beat partner, and I said, I know this question's coming.
Yep.
And I don't really have Urban Meyer and I never had a shouting thing. I mean, it was never like that. Ryan Day and I never, it's, you know, no NFL, Marvin Lewis could be difficult to deal with, but it was never like that. But it's actually before I was even a journalist. When I was in college, I went to Washington University in St. Louis and worked at the Sporting News as an intern when it was still based in St. Louis. And I got the job because I basically played softball or I played shortstop on the softball team.
I don't like humble brags on this podcast, Bill. Okay, let's not, we get it.
You know, I was not a bad shortstop when I was 21. I wasn't bad.
Right.
So I wrote my history thesis on how the St. Louis Cardinals survived the Depression in World War II. And the historian of the Sporting News then, Paul McFarland, was friends with Leo DeRocher, who had played on the Depression-era Cardinals teams. He was one of the few left. And so I contacted him said, I'm doing this thesis. Can I talk to you? He said, yeah, I don't think it'll be a problem. And so we arranged a time and I call him and I'm in St. Louis. He's in Florida. And I said, okay, I'm going to, you know, we said, hi, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to tape this. And I think in Missouri, you had to inform somebody that you were going to tape it. And it was all contraptions. You like plugged onto the phone. It was like, it was, you know, I'm not sure it even worked, but whatever. And he says, oh, you're taping this? I was like, well, yes, I want to, you know, get this accurate. He said, oh, no, you can't tape me. I'm like, why? He said, oh, you just can't. I mean, Leo DeRocher, he had a reputation for being a jerk. I mean, that was kind of his whole brand, right? He said, no, the only way you can interview me is if you come down here and do it in person. I'm like, I'm a college student in St. Louis, Missouri. I can't fly to Florida to interview you for a thesis. And so he would not budge. And when I was just so like shocked and pissed. So I don't know if confrontation is the word, but that I don't know that any of your other guests are ever going to pull Leo DeRocher out of their hat.
Okay. I just want to say, because it just popped in my head. When I was a high school senior, I was a sports editor of my student newspaper, the Mailpack High School Chieftain. And somehow or another, I got Victor Kiam, the owner of the New England to do an interview with me on the phone. And that was, for me, it was huge. And his secretary arranged it. And she said, okay, call at this time. And I call and they patch me through to Victor Kiam, who I'm pretty sure was in his car going somewhere, like his limousine. And I go, hey, Mr. Kiam, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm the writer from Mailpack High School. He said, who are you? Well, my name's Jeff. He goes, I high school. I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't have time for this. I'm sorry. I don't have any time for this. And he hung up on me. So Leo DeRocher, Victor Kiam, it happens.
We all get turned down by the great ones.
It also dates you and me that Leo DeRocher died in 1991. He's been dead for 32 years.
I'm pretty sure that nobody else is going to have a confrontation with Leo DeRocher.
No, that's very funny. Well, listen, Bill, I appreciate you doing this. I mean, I think you're a freaking one of the great pros in this business. And like you cover this team with legit integrity. You're not a homer. You go hard at it. It's just like, it's the way to go in this age of homerism, especially in college sports and college sports coverage. To me, you're like a role model how to do it. So bravo to you, even though it looks like you are sitting in a cracked in.
Well, I'm not. It's actually a nice little cabin, but I appreciate that. You know, it's, I do feel at times like I'm a bit of a dinosaur. There are times in this clickbait era where you just feel like it'd be a lot easier to just do the easy way, you know, do the easy thing and the sensational thing and not go in depth on anything because is it worth the trouble? But it is worth the trouble.
I appreciate it.
I want to thank today's guest, Bill Rabinowitz, for joining me on Two Riders Sling and Yang. You can follow Bill on Twitter at BRDispatch and read his work in the Columbus Dispatch. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Sling and Yang, please, please, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the momentous MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep riding.